Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Issues of the law never seem far removed from the headlines of the day. We'll talk about an expected attempt to override the governor's veto of a gun bill. Rex Sinkfield is a man who's contributed millions to political candidates. Now he's going to court to fight an attempt to cap contributions. Is Albert Pujols going to sue Jack Clark? When you sign a contract not to compete in your field, how binding is it, or should it be? And what about that rodeo clown in Missouri? Some wonder if freedom of expression extends to wearing an unflattering mask of the president. I'm Don Marsh. We'll be talking about it on today's Legal Roundtable with Mark Smith, Assistant Vice Chancellor at Washington University and Director of the Career Center there. Bill Freigvogel directs the School of Journalism at SIU Carbondale. And Heather Cole is Senior Reporter for Missouri Lawyers Media, which publishes the Missouri Lawyers Weekly. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to see you. Heather, welcome back again.
Thank you.
A return engagement. It's always good to see you. Okay, let's start with the expected attempt to override the governor's veto of the gun control bill. It's interesting because there's a supremacy issue at stake here, Bill. But our friend Dave Rowland, who's been on this program many times, thinks that there is a case to be made against the supremacy law rule. What do you make of that?
Well, I have a lot of respect for Rowland, and he's been a good guest for us. But I don't really agree with him here. Both the governor and the attorney general, Koster, have in their veto message and in a letter said that they believe that this bill.
May I just say it's the amendment, Second Amendment Protection Law. Right, just so that folks know exactly what we're talking about.
Right, and what it does is it says, amongst other things, that Missouri doesn't recognize a whole host of federal gun laws that Missouri believes restrict Second Amendment rights, that local law enforcement officials who would enforce those laws would be committing a crime, that they could be sued by the criminal whom they arrested, that publishing the name of a person who owns a gun or maybe a picture of a NRA student group, at their first deer hunting or something, publishing any of that kind of information is a crime. That's something that a lot of news organizations are concerned about. So the supremacy issue is. U.S. Constitution has a provision that says that federal law is the supreme law of the land and basically trumps contrary state laws and state constitutions. Now, Dave Rowland is saying that, well, going back as far as Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who wrote the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, that it's perfectly appropriate for a state legislature to say it disagrees with a federal law that was passed unconstitutionally. Of course, the problem with that argument here is that the Supreme Court has said these federal gun laws have been passed constitutionally. Also, the other problem with, I think, Dave's argument is that a lot of history has happened since then, the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. Both Governor Nixon's veto message and Koster's letter referred the legislature to a case called Cooper versus Aaron, which is sort of a famous – amongst constitutional lawyers, a famous case. And it occurred when Arkansas tried to say we don't believe the Supreme Court's right about desegregation of the schools. You know, back in the desegregation of the Little Rock schools, Supreme Court said, look, you got to follow the federal law, and the Supreme Court is the interpreter of what the Constitution means. So I think Dave's argument has some problems. But, and then even beyond that, Koster points out that some of the provisions of the law that could well be upheld still are not good policy, such yeah. as, that a law enforcement official would have to resign from any kind of a federal drug task force or guns task force, or that, let's say, a St. Louis police officer stopped a drug dealer in St. Louis, and the drug dealer had a fully automatic weapon that violates the 1934 gun law. But then presumably he can't refer that to a federal prosecutor, and if he were to, he'd be committing a crime.
Something. Go ahead, Heather.
A lot of the supporters have pointed out that marijuana laws passed in some states don't agree with the federal law. And I think the issue that Bill raised there about enforcement is kind of the key one then.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. Heather is right. I noticed that Anders Walker over at St. Louis, who's another one of our guests, you know, was sort of pointing out this, like from the other end of the political spectrum, you have these state legalization of marijuana laws. But that doesn't mean that the state of, say, who does that, Washington, California, they can't say, okay, federal government, you can't come in and enforce the federal law. And they can't even so it's not really exactly the same. It's the enforcement that gets –
I thought, just kind of building on what Bill said, Koster's
– the Attorney General.
Attorney General Koster's press conference was really smart because when you talk about the Supremacy Clause, I mean, I find that very interesting, but I understand most people just stop listening to me when I talk. And so it's a snooze. It's not that interesting. And it's a technical constitutional argument, and people don't care about it. But then Koster said, well, let's get past that. I think it's unconstitutional because, like Bill said, it's not for the states to decide constitutionality. It's for the United States Supreme Court government. We got this federal government. But he said, well, then let's see what it means. And it means city cops won't be able to cooperate with federal cops, that we might not be able to use the seizure laws for funds for – and so – he was kind of playing it out and saying, look at all these bad things are going to happen that nobody wants. And I think that was very smart. But who knows? This may be getting overridden. And then if it does get overridden, there's going to be a challenge. I think Bert Newman has already said he's going to challenge it, and I'm sure it'll get struck down.
Right. That was to be my next question, what happens now? Because there's a good chance that it will be overridden.
So given lawyers will make money.
Yeah, right.
And the state will pay it.
I mean, I think what Koster's suggesting is that parts of it might be struck down, but it might be that the whole law would not be struck down.
Right.
So you still could end up stuck with provisions that create this new cause of action for criminals to sue police officers who arrest them for gun crimes.
Yeah.
Well, it's a big deal. And we'll see. I guess next Tuesday or Wednesday, the 11th, is when the veto session begins. Okay, enough about that. Let's move on to our rodeo clown. I think most people are familiar with that. At the state fair in Sedalia, the clown put on an Obama mask and said some things that were unflattering and got a pretty positive reception from most of the audience, but not from everybody else. Does this clown, who hasn't gone to court and has not indicated that he would take the case to court, he's since left, he's prohibited from appearing at any rodeos in Missouri again. Does he have a First Amendment case, or would he have a First Amendment case, Heather, if he decided to sue?
Well, my colleague Donna Walter did some work on this, and what some of the law professors were telling her was that it was less about free speech than it was about employment law in some ways, which is that if you're an employee in some shape of the Missouri State Fair and they get some sort of right to control the message. So he's kind of out of luck on that end of things.
So it would have been different if they had told him, you can't make fun of Obama, but if you want to make fun of the Republicans, that's okay. Then that's a different issue. But what they're saying is we want to have a family event where a non-controversial event. So don't talk about politics. Don't talk about sex. Don't talk about, all the things you're not supposed to talk about. I think they're fine doing that, and I don't think he has any kind of claim to say I have some right to, and while I'm out there being a clown, now interject my political views.
I mean, if somebody in the audience had said, I'm going to put on an Obama mask and make fun of the president, they would have had protected First Amendment rights. But because there's this, employment relationship that says we want this particular kind of act at the state fair, that limits the First Amendment claims that the clown could make.
It's interesting. Some people have suggested that the real problem is that the president is African American, and that if a few years ago it had been a George W. Bush mask, there would not have been this kind of response. I think
there's something to that. I mean, I think you've got this whole legacy of race in our country, and it's hard to separate that from the situation. But having said that, I think if somebody puts a George Bush mask on, there are going to be some people who get upset about it, and I think you could see the same kind of thing happen. But I understand what people are saying, and I think personally, I think there's some truth to it, but I don't think that it's unwarranted.
I mean, a protester at a protest in a public square could burn the president in effigy, mm-hmm. and that would be protected speech, just like Ku Klux Klan people can burn crosses out in farm fields. But you can't. But if you're hired by the state of Missouri to put on a family friendly act, you can't do that.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get bogged down on this issue because it's not something that has gone to court. But we do have a call. Jerry in O'Fallon wants to talk about this. So while we're talking about it, let's bring him in. Go ahead, Jerry.
Good morning. Yes, your panelists made my point. I think the right of free speech allows me to say, go and, you know, maybe even in public, say to my boss, I think you have the IQ of a turnip. But it doesn't protect me from the consequences. Mm-hmm. And I feel the same way, actually. I mean, I'm always baffled by these. Well, actually, now it's been codified into law where you can, as a pharmacist, decline to, because it's not in your moral belief, to decline to prescribe, certain medications. And I think certainly you have that right to do that. I'm not sure you have the right to keep your job, just as if you went to work at a high-end restaurant and said, well, you know, someone asked for a cocktail, and you say, I really don't believe that, you know, you should be ordering alcohol. Again, you have the right to say that, but I don't think the law should exactly protect your employment in that case. That's, right. Anyway, thank you.
I think that's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, we don't give legal advice, but that sounds like good advice, not to call your boss a turnip.
Yeah. You don't have any First Amendment right.
Before we take a break and before we go on to other subjects, Jay in Normandy wants to discuss one that we already have raised. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air. Jay? One more time. Jay, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Finally, go ahead, please.
Yeah, guys. On the proposed.
Okay, Jay, I'm going to ask you to hang up and call back. We have a terrible connection with you, and we can't understand anything that you're saying. So try again, or if you're on your cell phone, move to a higher location, if you would, okay? That's Jay in Normandy. We'll get him back a little bit later, I hope. We have to take our first break. Let's do that now. This is Legal Roundtable Day. My guests in studio are Heather Cole, senior reporter for Missouri Lawyers Media. Bill Freivogel is with us from SIU in Carbondale, and from Washington University, Mark Smith. Back in just a moment to continue the conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable discussion. With me in studio is Heather Cole from the Lawyers Weekly, Bill Freivogel from SIU Carbondale, and Mark Smith from Washington University. I want to bring up a subject that's been getting a lot of attention, and it seems like every couple of weeks there's a new dimension to it, and that's the Larry Connor situation, having been dismissed in May from KMOV for certain things that he said on Facebook that his employers found objectionable. He was terminated, and he's filed an anti-defamation suit, and he's filed an age discrimination suit. But the one that I want to talk about is the non-compete clause that he is trying to have waived in his case. This prohibits him from working in this market for a year following the termination. He says that he's got to earn a living, et cetera, et cetera. What about non-compete clauses? I mean, I've heard of cases where they are upheld and cases where they are not. What do you think, Mark?
Well, so in Missouri, for a covenant not to compete to be enforceable, it has to be reasonable as to time, how long it lasts. And I think we were talking before the show, we think this one's about a year.
It is a year.
Which would be reasonable. And geography. So, if it's the market, say like 100 miles, that would probably be reasonable. But then, and the Missouri Supreme Court is kind of going back and forth, but they seem to also be requiring that there needs to be some protectable employer interest. So trade secrets, customer lists, things like that. Now here, I think the argument, and that's where what I'm hearing the issue is going to be. It's not so much about the reasonable. Is does KMOV have a protectable interest? And I think their argument would be, we invested all this money in promoting Larry Connors as the anchor of our news. We've made you into a household brand that's throughout the region. And if we have you go to another station, well, you've taken all this kind of goodwill that we've invested in you, and you're using it against us. And so, I mean, I don't. There may be more complicating factors to it, but I would think that would be their argument. And to me, it sounds like it's probably a pretty good argument.
But if you sign a contract and you agree to this,
well, that's the other thing. But there are times.
I guess so.
But the courts don't like these covenants not to commit. This is America. You know, you're supposed to be able to work, and this is counter to our public policy of letting everyone work. So the courts take a real close look at these. In Missouri, they do something called blue penciling. If it's too broad, like, they'll typically cut it back to what's reasonable. Some states take the view, if it's too broad, we'll just undo the whole thing. But I mean, I think for listeners, you know, if your employer says you got to sign this employment contract and it contains a covenant not to compete, I would assume that that's enforceable against you, and don't do it with the idea, oh, I'll be able to get out of it later because I've heard people can get out of these.
The time to challenge it is before you sign the contract.
Yeah.
Right. Go ahead, Heather.
Doesn't it have something to do, too, with the similarity of the employer you're going to? Like if he wanted to go and start a gardening center, that would be okay.
Exactly. I mean, yeah.
Well, it has everything to do with it. I think popularity is considered kind of a commodity, and if he takes it from one place to another after they've spent all this money. Bill, do you have thoughts on this?
I just wonder whether – I wonder just from a journalistic rather than a legal point of view. I mean, his episode shows the dangers that a lot of journalists face these days making comments on Facebook that – for, you know, that they really need to be held to, and that in this case would seem he was implying that maybe he was investigated by the IRS because of an interview, a hostile interview with President Obama, and he had absolutely no, you know, said, oh, I was just raising a question, you know, and so his journalistic ethics, I think, would be a little bit subject to question.
Well, and to me, it's somewhat preposterous to think that, particularly having seen that interview, that the President of the United States is going to call up the IRS and say, let's go after this guy.
He
asked about my taking vacations with my family.
He's also said that, well, this is also retaliation for me bringing forward a complaint of age and sex discrimination. And apparently this was handled in an arbitration, and they agreed to not disclose it. But KMOV has said, well, since he's talking about, we're going to talk about it a little bit and they say, I don't know if this is true or not, but they say all his claims were unfounded. So it always gets, you know, I used to do these kind of employment cases and, you know, when you have a plaintiff who's saying, well, it's this, no, I'm saying it's this, now I'm saying it's this, that makes it tougher for them because, you know, what is it?
He also claims that he has another job if this thing can be resolved.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
And that could very well be,
I can't think that the fighting about it's helping the brand or the popularity very much, though.
Yeah. Well, I wonder myself, you know, who is out there who would want to bring him on. But that's for the courts to decide. Another personality in the news is Albert Pujols. And as far as I know, he has not filed suit against Jack Clark.
No.
Jack Clark made an accusation on another radio station that Albert used steroids, performance-enhancing drugs. The issue here is I'm seeing a lot of people recommending that he not bother to sue because, Albert, there's no way he can win, not because he did or did not use steroids, but simply because, as a public person, he's not going to win a libel suit.
Oh, I think he could win a libel suit. You know, to prove this, you got to prove six elements. You got to prove – I wrote them down here. You got to prove that – there was a publication. This was said on the air. So that would be a defamatory statement. That would be you're using these illegal drugs. Identified the plaintiff. That would be Pujols. You can prove it false. He says, I didn't do it. And it sounds like the guy who Jack Clark says told him says, I never told him that. And it's published with intentional malice. And this is the thing. You don't have to prove bad acts. You just have to prove that you knew it was false when you said it, and that there were some damages. So, I mean, do I think this is a smart move for him to do? Probably not. I would just let it drop. But does he have a chance of winning? I think he does.
But doesn't a public persona have
it's a higher standard? You got to have this malice, and you got to know that.
Yeah, it's really hard for a public figure or a public official to win a libel case. It's not impossible, but it's this actual malice, reckless disregard for the truth that Clark knew it was wrong when he said it, And so just like carelessness, that's not enough.
Enough, right. I mean, it's got to be more than recklessness, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Jack Clark seems to be taking it very seriously. He hired Chet Pleben, who's known for aggressiveness.
Right. Well, you know, I wonder whether Albert Pujols would really want to be. It seems like that could lead, if there were a suit, couldn't it lead to depositions and questions?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that's the big risk. If you file suit, then you open up your whole life to examination. Does he want to be deposed under oath about a lot of stuff? I'm not saying he's done anything bad, but I think most of us would rather not have to get in front of a hostile lawyer for a couple of days and have them ask any question they want where we have to answer under oath. You know, so that's just not a good situation.
And suing would just turn this from something that everybody will have forgotten about in 6 months to something that we'll be writing about for years.
And then becomes the supposition that he probably was doing something
wrong.
It's just, it doesn't go away.
Yeah, because you're protesting so hard, you know, that maybe you got something to hide.
I think it's me thinks that
protest
too much. Jay called back from Normandy. Let's bring him in and get that subject that he wanted to address. Go ahead, Jay. Thanks for calling back.
Yeah, guys. Sorry I cut out the bad cell. On this House Bill 436, I've been told.
Which one is that?
Amendment Freedom Act.
Not everybody knows the bill by their number. That's why I just want to be clear on that.
Right. It supposedly would promote open carry. It would make federal law enforcement officers subject to possible arrest. My question is, if these guys in the legislature, I can't understand where they're coming from, but if they do override the governor's veto next week, and then the feds say, or it goes to court, are some of the parts of this bill going to survive? It should all die, but are some of the parts of the bill going to actually survive? We have then possibly open carry if they get rid of the thing about federal law enforcement officers could be arrested. So that's kind of my question.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. You may have missed it. We had discussed that a moment ago. Bill, do you want to just repeat what you said?
Yeah, just very briefly. That was the Attorney General Koster's point was that he thought it was possible that some parts of the bill would survive a court challenge that was based on the Supremacy Act, and that two portions of the bill that might survive would be the ones that said that state law enforcement officers couldn't enforce federal laws, participate with federal law enforcement officers, and that they would be subject to a new cause of action, an expansion of tort liability that would enable a criminal to sue a law enforcement official who was trying to enforce a federal gun law.
You know, one of the things that occurs to me is, I mean, I feel the same way as the caller, which is the legislature spending all their time on things like this, which are probably going to be struck down, the banning the Sharia law, some other things we've talked about in the past. And we've got the Turner case, the transfer, which needs to be addressed. It's going to be a hard issue to solve, and it's going to take a lot of a thoughtful solution. And they keep punting on that one. They won't look at it. So,
Plus, I read a letter that or an email that Gene is it Manicky, who is the Missouri Press Association person, the lawyer for them, wrote to all sorts of editors around the state of Missouri, saying, "Look, even though this is the portion of this bill that says it's a crime to publish if a person owns a gun, even though that's clearly unconstitutional, a violation of the First Amendment." Nevertheless, it could be enforced for a while.
Yeah.
So you as newspaper editors and radio and TV editors have to decide whether you want to risk being charged before that provision of the law is thrown out.
Speaking of the Turner case, the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, is not happy with the Kirkwood school system nor the Melville district. Over the transfer of students. What do you make of that? Heather, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, I think this comes down to if you send these things to the courts, they may not be focused as much on the practical matter of implementing it as they are on this is what the law says. You have to follow it regardless of, you know, whatever results may be. So with the gun law, that may be a good argument for not getting it to the courts. I think they have a valid point that it doesn't say that you can limit the number who are coming. I think they have a point.
What we're dealing with here is class size. Both of these districts, as I recall it correctly, were saying they had a limitation in class size and therefore couldn't take as many students as
I think they've taken a couple hundred. Sounds like there's 2,000 who want to transfer. They're going to other districts as well.
It's looked upon as a device to really hold back on the number of students coming in.
Yeah, so after the Missouri Supreme Court ruled earlier this summer that the transfer law had to go forward, DESE issued this advice saying districts can limit how many students they take based on class size constraints. And what the ACLU letter says is that DESE guidance has no force of law. The Missouri Supreme Court, the opinion saying that districts have to accept the students who request places, that's what has force of law. And they will go on to say that the state of Missouri, has actually created a liberty interest, a federal constitutional liberty interest that's enforceable in federal court by a student, a liberty interest to choose of a student in an unaccredited district to choose an accredited school to go to, and it's a violation of federal due process of law for county districts to deny those transfers.
You got to be sympathetic, though, to Kirkwood and Melville because and this is what they said. Look, we came to this in good faith. We're trying to do what we can. Melville apparently already takes a bunch of kids from the city. So what are they supposed to do if they – and I don't know what their situation is, but, you know, what if they don't have any more classrooms? Are they supposed to bring trailers in to do this? Do they have to hire teachers?
I think some of them have.
Yeah, if you hire a teacher for one grade, if you get 30 more kids, that'll work. But if you only have 12 more kids, I think this is very difficult, and it would be nice for the legislature to give some guidance instead of everyone trying to feel around in the dark trying to figure out what to do.
You're really on the legislature.
I am. It's too bad.
Well, we've talked about this before, and I think you're right. The fact that a lot of time is wasted and has been wasted in recent sessions on minutia stuff that really
goofball
is more
stuff.
More politically motivated than anything else.
I mean, it was nice to see that it seems like a lot of the county districts were very welcoming when the students arrived, and that was in contrast to some of the initial reactions that some of those districts had. So I was really glad to see those suburban schools sort of pull it together and be very positive.
And it seems to have gone quite smoothly.
One of the reports I read, I think it said that the principal at the Clayton school called this mother to say, "Your child's." I mean, that's pretty nice that the principal, that someone high up is making the calls. I think that shows a very welcoming.
Was
nice.
That's good to hear. Let's move on to something else here. Since we last got together, the Justice Department announced that it will no longer pursue mandatory minimum sentences for certain low-level nonviolent drug offenders. Attorney General Holder says incarceration is neither effective nor sustainable. What do you think about that?
I think it's sort of a long time coming, actually, because the United States has an incredibly large portion of its population in prison, and a lot of it is a substantial portion of that federal prison overcrowding is the result of enforcement of mandatory minimum sentences for low-level drug crimes. So what the Attorney General is saying is that he's asking federal prosecutors to charge in such a way that it doesn't trigger this kind of mandatory minimum that a federal judge has to then impose.
And I think the federal judges don't like these mandatory because they can't take into account extenuating factors. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to have some judge who's way out of line, and so you would like to have some consistency, but cases are different, and by doing this, you completely tie the judge's hands to allow them to deal with the particular situation.
And Heather, it's going to save a lot of money because it costs a lot of money to put people away.
I think Eric Holder made the point about exactly it was some extraordinary proportion of the world population in prison is from the U.S.
Yeah, I think he said it was 25% of the world's prison population is in the United States, whereas we only have 5% of the world's population.
As an aside, I heard the other day, and I was quite startled to hear these numbers, that there are more African Americans incarcerated in American prisons than there were slaves in this country.
Really?
So, yeah, that's really hard to deal with that. Speaking of this, before we take our next break, this is kind of an aside. It's a dead issue, no pun intended, but Ariel Castro, who committed suicide the other day, he's the man who held those three young women captive in Cleveland mm-hmm. for so many years. He was sentenced to life in prison plus 1,000 years. Now, what is the point? I've heard so many people ask this question. What is the point, speaking of sentencing, of tacking on 1,000 years to a life sentence where there's no possibility of parole? Can someone tell me?
I guess just to express the outrage. I mean, if you're not going to execute him because you've got, I guess it was some sort of a deal there.
Yeah.
At least say you're going to be there forever and ever.
To make sure you never get out. That there's not going to be, because I guess with life, then they say, well, life is basically this many years, and so we could look at parole. So this gets around that, and I think it sends a message. And while I'm against other political statements, I was for that political statement. I'm okay with that, with the judge saying, we're just making it clear, you're never getting out.
Any thoughts from you, Heather, on that?
just second.
Okay. It is interesting, isn't it? He kept these women under these horrific conditions for 10 years, more than 10 years, and he could only take 30 days mm-hmm. before he decided to check out. Okay, enough of that. Let's move on to other things, but we'll have to take a break before we do so. Legal Roundtable Day, guests in studio, Heather Cole, Bill Freivogel, and Mark Smith. Back in just a moment, we'll take your calls at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or you can send us a tweet at STL On Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. Before we continue that conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Missouri Department of Elementary and Secondary Education updated its guidelines for parents who want to transfer their students to unaccredited school districts. The Missouri Department of Transportation plans to shut down several lanes of I-64 and the Poplar Street Bridge this weekend. And on our website, we've updated our ongoing data project tracking the amount of money Missouri lobbyists give to legislators. The updated numbers show $11,000 in Cardinals and Royals baseball tickets. Visit our website at stlpublicradio.org to view that story and others, and join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news. Okay, a couple of other things I'd like to get to as time begins to move on us. Rex Sinkfield, as we all know, has pumped millions of dollars into various political campaigns and various causes over the years here in Missouri. There is a proposal for a 2014 ballot measure to limit campaign contributions to $2,600 for candidates running for statewide office. Rex is going to court. He wants to stop this because apparently he wants to give a lot more than that. Is there anything more than any more comment needed for that story, or not?
Well, we're kind of in the Wild West in Missouri right now. We have no limits whatsoever on campaign finance, and so it's kind of out of control. I'm not questioning his motives or anything. He seems like he's trying to do some good things, but I think it's Jason Kander, who's the Secretary of State, has kind of proposed some what I think are pretty reasonable limitations for campaign contributions, and but it just seems like it never gets through the legislature. They're on the inside, the money's flowing. Why would you want to cut that off?
I mean, the current state of campaign finance law is that that states and the federal government can set mm-hmm. campaign contribution limits of I think currently they're around $2,600 for donations to particular candidates. The Citizens United case that we talk about a lot says, well, there's no limitations on contributions, including by corporations, on behalf of candidates. So like independent expenditures, mm-hmm. Elect this guy because he's great, but I'm not giving straight to his campaign. I'm buying the time on radio or TV. The U.S. So it would seem as though the petition that I think these actually anti-abortion group is circulating to try to reimpose campaign contribution limits to candidates in Missouri. It would seem as though that would probably be constitutional, unless the U.S. Supreme Court changes its mind. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court actually has a case that they're going to be hearing this coming fall, which is whether or not what are called aggregate campaign contribution limits, more than you wanted to know, are constitutional. So, for example, there's a Alabama businessman, a Republican contributor, who gives lots of contributions, and he always stays underneath the hard limit of $2,600. But he gives so many that he violates the aggregate limit, which is like in the 30s or 40s, thousands of dollars. And so the Supreme Court is going to hear that case. And given that in five campaign finance cases, they've always ruled on behalf of free speech and more campaign contributions. Those limitations might be in question.
I was wondering if Citizens United might help Singfield's case out at all, or does that?
Yeah, well, I mean, in Citizens United, they did try to stay away from reconsidering the hard contribution limits on contributions to candidates. But you know, certainly the direction that the court is going would be sympathetic to Singfield's position. Of course, Singfield is the largest campaign contributor in the state of Missouri
giving millions of dollars.
Oh, absolutely.
I think $26 million since 2008.
Yeah, it's something in that neighborhood, which is quite a neighborhood when you come to the one or two more things I want to touch upon before going to the phones. We have a number of calls. Missouri Republican Representative Paul Whelan is going to court against the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in another attempt to undermine Obamacare. He says his inability to opt out of coverage for what he calls abortion-inducing drugs violates his religious freedom. Does he have a case, Heather?
This one was really interesting because it's his personal insurance as opposed to being an employer challenging it. And there's a number of I'm not familiar with any other personal challenges like this. I know the employer cases have kind of split on the appellate courts. There's been a variety of success on those. So I'm not quite sure how this will go.
Yeah, there are about 60 different. I don't know how this one will go either. It is different than the others. There are about 60 cases. In the federal courts that are in all the courts that have challenged this particular requirement of Obamacare that that any kind of health insurance include contraceptive care, particularly a lot of these challenges have been from religious fundamentalists or the Catholic Church, and the Obama argument is, well, we're accommodating their religious beliefs, we don't make the churches do it, and when there's like a church hospital, we're not charging it's actually the financial burden is placed upon the insurer rather than on the church hospital, so that this we're already accommodating religion. So I don't know. We'll see. I think it's going to be an interesting case.
But you can imagine it escalating to – so I'm someone who believes that vaccinations are wrong, or I believe in the healing power of the Lord, and so I don't want any kind of medical doctor. What do I do then with my health care and everything?
Or young people opting out of various provisions that deal essentially with older people, that sort of thing. Okay. Now, the one final thing before before we go to the phones is we've heard so much on NPR and all the other networks, radio and television, about the debate over Syria. And the resolution on Syria. The thing that comes to my mind is President Obama taking this now and putting it before Congress as he has. Has he tied the hands of future presidents who would choose to do something like this, go into an area and a police action of some sort where they would have to go to Congress before making that kind of a move?
I think it's going to make it harder for future presidents to take a limited military action on their own.
Because he does have the authority right now to do it on his own if he wants.
I think he does have that authority. I don't think he had to go to Congress for the authority to take this kind of strike. I don't think that any president has gone to Congress for such a limited strike before. So I think that this will be something of a precedent that other I don't mean a legal precedent, but something that other presidents in similar situations will have to deal with.
I'm sure future Congresses would make a point of pointing to this as a president, right?
And it's going to be very interesting. I think Obama's sort of, you know, playing a little poker here and trying to call the bluff of these members of Congress. But if they don't authorize this, I mean, I think he's going to have to go ahead and do it anyway. And so then what? Yeah. Then what? Is that an impeachable offense? Right. Yeah, I don't think so. But I could sure see people claiming that.
In this environment, I don't think there's any question that would happen. Okay, let's go to the phones. And I recognize the name of a frequent caller on the program, Rory Ellinger, representative from University City. He's joining us once again. Go ahead, Rory. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Don. Hello to the panelists. I just want to comment on a couple things that are coming up that I think the panel and the public would be interested in. We failed to get through the legislature this year, the reform of the criminal code. And there's two really important. That'll come up again. We got it passed through the House, but there's a couple issues that have really sort of come to the fore and that are very important. One would do away, if we revise the criminal code as it passed the Missouri House, it would do away with three strikes and you're out. You know, right now in Missouri, if you commit three drug felonies, you can go to prison for life. Now, that could be three different occasions, admittedly. And it could all just be with marijuana changes, nothing greater than that. But they could be felonies. And so you would get life in prison for that. And there's about 80-some men in the penitentiary system out of 30,000, roughly, that are in prison, that are under that, I think, pretty serious situation. So that would be looked at. And the other thing is that this, the whole issue of marijuana was addressed originally, but it got dropped from the House passage. There seems to be a really sizable change in the Missouri legislature, much more compassion for this, and not just because one of our party got in some difficulty over this. It seems to be really people are seriously looking at this. Prosecutors now are independently across the state, in effect doing what they passed in Columbia, Missouri. I think that would be a real step forward. We have so many young people's lives just totally messed up because they pled guilty to a little marijuana possession charge on the Current River one day, and they didn't even know they had a conviction until they applied for a job. I think we can see some real positive movement in the legislature, including among many Republicans, I'm very proud to say. So I just wanted to point those two things out, that you have the Holder statements that he's made about we really need to look at that. We have this revelation today that I heard Don just say about the number of African Americans in prison greater than the time of slavery that we had under slavery. There are some other movements that are more positive here in Missouri that I'm hopeful our next session will address.
We all are, Rory. Thank you so much for the call. Mark, anything you wanted to mention with regard to that? You've been attacking the legislature today.
Yeah, no, and I'm not attacking individual legislatures, but I think that would be a good thing. I know they tried. I mean, it seemed like they almost had the agreement on that criminal revision. I thought that would be a good thing.
I know Rory has worked very hard on that, and as Mark just said, I think that they really had buy-in from both the prosecutors and the public defenders. I guess my impression is that it was just such a big effort that it ended up not able to be done in the last session. But maybe that is something that will happen this coming one.
Yeah, it was quite an overhaul.
Right. Let's take another call. Dennis in Overland joins us. Go ahead, Dennis.
I think the big question in Missouri is who isn't getting money from Rex Singfield? It would be interesting to get a list, and I don't think the list would be very long because evidently he's spending an awful lot of money.
Well, all four hands have gone up in the studio, I want to tell you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's good to know. And how about you?
Well, I'm the fourth.
I put my hands up twice because I ran for office and tried to get some, yeah.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Yes, Rex is fairly prolific when it comes to spending his significant dollars. Another call here. Jim in St. Louis, go ahead. Jim, are you with us?
This is Kristen.
Oh, okay, Kristen. Jim, if you're still with us, we'll take you next. Kristen, go ahead.
Thank you. Just real quickly, I had my identity stolen a few years ago, and I have been tossed from every government agency I could think of, the FBI, the Secret Service, district attorneys, and everybody just kind of wants to push me on to the next agency. What can people like me do to get justice for, you know, against this type of crime? Because they know who did it. They just don't want to go through the motions of actually prosecuting her for it.
Thanks, Kristen. I almost stole your identity again by calling you Jim, but I wasn't intending to do that. I'm not. Do we have an answer? I do. My son was a victim of identity theft, and basically it's a long, long process dealing with it. But ultimately you have to go to the attorney general of your state and work it backwards through that. So that would be my suggestion for you, is to contact the attorney general's office. Okay.
It sounds like she's having problems getting the people to prosecute, maybe not Yeah, and I don't know what you do in that kind of situation.
Well, it's sorry we can't be more helpful than that, Kristen. Unfortunately, we're not in a position here to be giving legal advice. We talk about some of the issues rather than try to do that. All righty, let's see if Jim is with us after all and get his question or comment in. Jim, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I don't mind you mixing me up. Can you hear me?
I can, but time's getting away from us, Jim, so go ahead, please.
I'm curious if a failing school district can limit the students to that it transfers to the failing students. Make the argument you're making an A, a B, a C. You've got a good grade point average. We're not failing you. You're not going to transfer.
No.
Why? Yeah.
They cannot do that because the state law is very clear that any student who would be within an unaccredited district would have this right.
And they have to pay the other district for these students who are leaving. So I think they're saying that one of the school districts is going to have problems this year with the money, and the legislature is going to have to come in and figure out some solution for what are we going to do with these all this money coming out following these students who are transferring.
$35 million bucks involved in all of this movement of students. We'll try to take a very quick call from Mark and Arnold, but Mark, it does have to be quick. Go ahead, please.
Okay, I'll try to be as brief as I can. I guess I was calling to give some counterpoint to Jay's comments about the gun law. You know, if some parts of it are found unconstitutional, so be it. But, you know, things like open carry is maybe not for me or anyone else, but it's probably not as big a deal as some people want to make it out to be. We certainly saw that with concealed carry. There was all the hue and cry, and it's been basically a non-issue. And I would just challenge you to have some panelists sometime that don't have a lockstep view against guns and the Second Amendment.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mark, for the call.
I would just point out one thing you see, this isn't going to satisfy you, but you see a lot in a lot of the criticisms that the state legislators make in the rationales for passing this is they say, well, we have a president who is against the Second Amendment. They seem to forget that the president has said repeatedly, as has the governor, that they support and has the attorney general, that they support the Second Amendment. And as a matter of fact, the president supported the Heller decision saying that people have a right to have a gun in their house to defend themselves. So I think that sometimes this claim of anti-Second Amendment bias is overblown.
Okay, we'll let it go at that, except that we want to spend a little bit of time. Mark Smith, I know that's something you brought to our attention early this morning. You want to recognize someone who is no longer with us.
Right. So Kathy Bricky, who was on the faculty of the WashU Law School, she passed away recently. And just, she was a real figure in her field. The New York Times just last spring referred to her as the dean of white-collar crime, I mean, as a national expert in this area. She wrote her three-volume text on corporate white-collar crime. She published it 17 years before Enron, way ahead of the curve on this, and just came out with a volume on environmental crimes. And just in addition to all that, was just a wonderful woman. I worked with her. I had her when I was a student, and I worked with her at the law school. And she and her husband, Jim, who's a lawyer, just really nice people. So it's a real loss.
Only 15 seconds left. Any other comment from the—
I just second that real quickly. She was a great source. When I was trying to write about white-collar crime that I didn't know anything about, she would tell me what the case was.
going to have to leave it at that. Heather Cole, thanks so much for being with us today. Bill Frivol and Mark Smith, thank you for being with us. That's the end of our Legal Roundtable. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk with soprano Christine Brewer about arts and faith in St. Louis's third annual September 11th Interfaith Commemoration in Music. He'll also talk with members of the Ariana String Quartet about their season-opening concert. He'll also discuss the Contemporary Art Museum's 10th anniversary. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at a new report on the health and well-being of African Americans in the St. Louis area. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, Kristen Torres, and Spencer Reed. Executive producers Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.